بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين. Dear brothers and sisters, سلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته. There's a set of ahadith, a set of traditions that we have, which speak of the exemption of the khums, where the khums is exempted for the believers. By believers, I mean the Shia denomination. And here, at different times throughout the period of formation, throughout the time of the Holy Messenger and the successors of the Holy Messenger, there were periods where the khums was not necessary to be given. Or rather, in a more technical sense, the khums was exempted for the Shias. And here, the scholars, the religious authorities, in relation to this exemption, in relation to these ahadith, these reports or traditions on the exemption of the khums, the scholars have interpreted different jurisdictions of exemption. So they look at all the ahadith and they conclude a specific jurisdiction in relation to when and where and how the khums is exempted for the Shias. Some have an extremist position where they have said that the khums is exempted until the coming of the 12th successor of the Holy Messenger. And until then, there's no obligation in relation to the khums. Although that is a relatively extreme position and is something which can't be held or can't be deemed very serious, because this is an instruction in the Holy Quran. It makes no sense to abrogate or to put on hold instructions of the Quran until the coming of the 12th Imam. The 12th Imam may come in 1,000 years' time. Don't we have a responsibility to incorporate the Quran in our lives? Now here, these, slide number 44, so there exist traditions where the Ahlul Bayt have exempted the Shias from paying the khums. Different interpretations have been given in relation to such traditions. Ayatollah Sistani's interpretation of these traditions, which we call the Tahleel traditions, the traditions of Tahleel, Tahleel meaning that being exempted. Ayatollah Sistani's interpretation can be structured, and his extrapolation of how much exemption there is can be structured in the following principle: that whatever is transferred to a believer, by a believer we mean a follower from the Shia denomination, whatever is transferred to a believer, it may be through buying and selling, it may be through giving presents, it may be through having a partnership. So whatever is transferred to a believer from a non-believer, meaning a non-Shia, be it a Christian, Jew, or brothers from a non-Shia denomination, or even a Shia who is not abiding, in this sense, not a khums giver. So whatever is transferred to an abiding Shia from a non-believer or a Shia that isn't abiding by the khums, that thing which is transferred to the believer is halal for the believer, khums-wise. Because the Christian or the Jew or the follower of another denomination, or the Shia which isn't practicing, i.e. doesn't give the khums or doesn't take the khums seriously, that which is transferred to the believer, that concrete thing which is transferred to the believer, will the Khums is levied on it. A fifth of it is the Imams. So what are you doing with it? Okay, you bought it, or you received it as a present, or you acquired it through partnership. But the Khums is levied upon it. Now, it may be through sales with a Christian, a Jew, a non-Shia, or a Shia who is not practicing, is not a Khums giver. So Khums will be levied upon it. Remember, the popular position was, or the majority position was, that Khums is levied on the concrete thing. And therefore, a fifth of that has to be given. But here, in relation to these categories, which we've just mentioned, Ayatollah Sistani says here, the Khums is not necessary for the believer. I.e., if they were to receive something, something was to be transferred to them from a Jew, a Christian, a non-Shia, or even a Shia who is not practicing the Khums. From any of these classes of people, if a thing is transferred, even though the Khums is levied on that thing, for the believer it would be halal to use, no problem whatsoever. They have been exempted. Although for the transferer, the exemption does not apply, and therefore they will be responsible. For example, for the Shia who is not a Khums giver, they will be responsible for not having given the Khums. Okay, so this is Ayatollah Sistani's interpretation. Now, if you remember, with Ayatollah Khamenei, the Khums is not levied on the concrete thing. It's upon your dhimma. It's upon your shoulders. It's something which, something you have to pay the Khums on it. It's now upon your shoulders. The Khums does not penetrate, does not diffuse or permeate in the concrete thing. For you to say one-fifth of that concrete thing is the Imams. And that was the popular position. With Ayatollah Khamenei, he says, no, that one-fifth, you are now in debt. It's upon you. It's upon your shoulders. It doesn't diffuse or permeate into the concrete thing which has to be khumsated. So the question arises that if one holds such a position, how will one interpret the ahadith of tahleel? Because here, when you receive from a Christian or a Jew or a non-Shia person from the non-Shia denomination, when you receive something from them, Khums isn't permeated or hasn't penetrated that thing. It's upon you now to give it. If it was penetrating that thing, then you're not allowed to exploit it. You're not allowed to use it. And then the ahadith of tahleel says, well, in these cases, you can use it. If it's from a Christian, Jew, non-Shia, or a Shia who's not abiding, according to Ayatollah Sistani. But here with Ayatollah Khamenei, it hasn't penetrated into that concrete item. So it's upon your shoulders, it's in your dhimma. And if that's the case, you can still use those things, those items. So when you can use them, what's the need for exemption? Why do you have to be exempted in the first place? Because Khums never entered those exact concrete items per se. It went into your dhimma, so you can still use those things. So why the talk of exemption? It's a subtle point. That's why the ahadith of tahleel, its jurisdiction, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, is Ayatollah Khamenei limits the scope, the jurisdiction, to non-Shias only, and only in the domain of death. So what does that mean? If a non-Shia, i.e. a Christian, Jew, a follower from another denomination, okay, not Shias who are not practicing, he doesn't include that class of people, a non-Shia, that's it. If they were to die, if that a non-Shia, so it's, for example, a Christian, a Jew, or, for example, someone from the Sunni denomination, if they were to die, because he limited to the domain of death only, if they were to die, the inheritors can take the inheritance, and they know that the deceased has not given the khums on his or her property, but they are exempted from paying the khums. So exemption applies in this case in such a manner. Because when someone has now deceased, there is no dhimma anymore. There is no liability for them. No active liability, so to speak. So the khums of the deceased would now, from their dhimmi, according to Ayatollah Khomeini's position, would now diffuse into their property. And so, theoretically, the inheritors cannot exploit such a property because it hasn't been khumsated. But here, the exemption qualifies and it's okay. There's no need to worry. It's not necessary to give the khums in such a narrow jurisdiction. So it only applies when, in the domain of death, when the person has died, and that person who has died is a non-Shia, Christian, Jew, or Sunni, for example. Here the inheritors need not worry about the khums. The khums has become exempted. So this is a very important principle, very subtle, and there are different interpretations by the different religious authorities. Now, given that, now let's speak about the significance of khums in one's practical life. Okay. Now, here, slide 45. Let's look at the middle column for now. In the middle column, it reads, now this middle column is something which was popular amongst the earlier religious authorities, but today there are differences of opinion. Before, this was the case, that assuming X item, X thing, has become levied with the khums, and one's khums year has arrived, and one has yet to pay it. So now they have to pay the khums. Once the khums date has arrived, they have to pay the khums on this item, which has been levied with the khums, and they didn't pay it. So they have X, and they haven't paid the khums on X. Exploiting or using X in such a case would be a case of usurpation. You're usurping it because it's the imam's too. A fifth of it was the imam's and you haven't paid it. So with every particle of that X item, you are in fact usurping it. You are exploiting something which is not yours without the consent, without the necessary consent. And hence, it would be haram to use X because you're using something which isn't yours without permission. And assuming that X is an edible food, for example, 10 kilograms of rice, and you didn't give its khums, which was 2 kilograms at the end of the year when your khums date arrived. And then with this 10 kilograms of rice, you didn't give its khums, you consumed or you gave away Y amount of that X. Y amount, Y percent or Y amount. Here, first of all, you would have to pay a fifth, a khums, on that Y amount which you gave away or you consumed yourself because that was the imam's. And even that 10 kilograms minus Y amount, that also had the khums levied on it. So, although I've complicated it with Y and 10 minus Y, at the end of the day, you have to pay the khums, the 2 kilograms of that 10 kilograms. But if you consume the Y amount, that Y amount, its chumas has to be given. That 10 minus Y, which remains, the chumas of that has to be given. Okay. Now, that was in relation to something edible, but let's say if it's a piece of land, okay, walking on that piece of land, which is yet to be chumsated, or is chums pending, as some brothers have used this term, which is a very useful term, and I benefited from it. Let's say if a piece of land is chums pending, yet to be chumsated, although the verb chumsated, others have used chumsified, which is also a very nice term. So if it's a piece of land and the chums hasn't been paid on it, walking on it would be haram. If it's a car which is chums pending and the year has passed, here driving in it would be haram. Even if one walks or drives or eats out of necessity, or walks in that land which is chums pending, or drives in a car which is chums pending, or eats from a food which is chums pending, but they did it to avoid serious burden, here that driving, walking and eating would be justified, but the liability issue still remains. It's still upon them to give the chums. Okay, so that is the position which was very common even 30 years ago. A lot of the religious authorities had such a position. But with Ayatollah Sistani now, given his understanding on the traditions of tahleel, this is how he analyzes such a scenario. He says, if the person, however, does not abide by or believe in the khums, and thus does not pay it, Ayatollah Sistani allows exploiting such an ex for believers, albeit a case of haram and usurpation for oneself, i.e. for the person who doesn't believe in the khums. They're a Shia, but they're not a khums giver, for example. And they have something, and they had 10 kilograms of rice, and they didn't pay the khums. Then you, a practicing Shia, a practicing believer, went to their house, and then you consumed that food. They gave away some kilograms of rice to you to consume. But that person who was the host wasn't a chums giver. Now for them, they have to pay the chums of that 10 kilograms and whatever they've given to you. But in relation for you, yourself, the person who was invited, they don't have to give the chums. Why? Because of the traditions of tahleel. Remember, any transfer from a non-Shia or a Shia who's not a practicer to a believer, there's no need to give the chums. It's halal for them. They are exempted from the chums. So whatever you've consumed there, it's okay for you. But for the host, whose duty was to pay the chums, but they didn't take it seriously, that responsibility will lie upon them. They still have to give it, because the chums entered that 10 kilograms of rice, it wasn't theirs. So they're indebted to the 12th Imam still. But for the person who was invited, there would be no problem there. The way Ayatollah Khomeini now would analyze this, that all will not apply for Ayatollah Khomeini. Why? Because the khums is transferred upon the person's shoulders, upon their dhimmah, and therefore makes him or her liable, period. Look, the khums didn't go into the 10 kilograms of rice. It went upon one's dhimmah. Okay? Now they are responsible. They are liable. But if they, it's gone upon their dhimme. Now, if they give the food to others, that would be unproblematic for the host and for the invited person. They can consume from it. That would be unproblematic because the khums wasn't levied on the actual rice. It went into their dhimme. But they're still liable. And delaying the liberation of their dhimme, freeing themselves from this liability, if they delay this freeing of themselves from the liability that they have, the responsibility of giving the khums, which is upon their shoulders, delaying this would be haram. Okay. But the difference here, the practical difference here, was the host with Aytullah Sistani wasn't allowed to consume, whereas the invited one was. With Aytullah Khomri, both the host and the invited one, they both can consume the rice. But the host shouldn't delay. And if they do delay freeing their dhimme upon which the khums is placed, that would be haram for them. But there's no problem for the person who was invited. They have no responsibility and they can consume from the food and it's okay. Because there's no khums in that rice in the first place, according to Ayatollah Khomeini. Whereas food, the khums was levied on the food, the concrete food, the concrete rice, according to Ayatollah Sistani. But the ahadith of tahleel frees the invited person. Okay. Another example now, another significant aspect of the khums. Assuming a seller sells X item to a buyer where the X item's khums had not been paid after the arrival of 1 year. So imagine there's a Shia brother, although who is not practicing, or a non-Shia in general terms, like a Christian or Jew, they don't have the khums, but a Sunni brother, or according to Ayatollah Sistani, a Shia brother who's not practicing, any of these classes. Here, so they have a shop, a toy shop, for example, and the khums of a particular toy was not paid. And now this toy, its khums date has arrived. This toy is now khums pending. And they want to pay it. They haven't paid it. Okay, so what happens here? With Ayatollah Sistani using the X item, the toy, for example, selling it in our scenario, would not be allowed. You haven't paid the khums on that toy or any other X item. If you want to sell it, a fifth of it wasn't yours, so you don't have the permission to sell it because a fifth of that hasn't been given to the imam and X item is khums pending. The year has arrived, the khums date has arrived. You have to pay it now. If you don't, you're usurping X item. So you're not even allowed to sell it. And if you do, it's a case of usurpation because the actual X is the Imam's too, a fifth of it. However, according to Ayatollah Sistani, were one to go ahead and sell it, the khums upon X item becomes transferred onto the seller's money received whilst the use of X becomes halal for the buyer. Look, this is another scenario of the traditions of tahleel. Let's say the Shia non-khums giver now sells X to me for me to purchase. For me, it's halal for me, that present. And it has no khums on it, according to Ayatollah Sistani, because of the traditions of tahleel. But for that person, they usurped that X item. And then they received my cash, which I paid for that item. Here, that responsibility, the khums upon X item, which they hadn't given, that seller now, for them, that the chumps on that which they did not give becomes transferred onto the buyer's money. So now the money I've given, because I've taken X item, for me using X item is unproblematic, but the money I've given, now the chumps is transferred onto that, and they still have to give the chumps a fifth of that money received from the buyer. Okay, so that was with Oitola system. With Oitola Khomeini, this transaction is sound, because with him, chumps goes on the dhimme, doesn't go on the actual concrete X item. And when it doesn't go on the concrete X item, you are free to use the X item as you will, in this case, selling it. So according to him, this transaction would be sound, there's no problem. And what happens is that the chumps, which is still pending, becomes transferred upon the seller's shoulders, and he's indebted to the 12th Imam. And the more he delays giving it, the more he's sinning. Okay. Okay, so that's another significant application or implication that the chumps has in our lives. Now, another scenario. Sometimes a legal entity, not a natural person, a legal person, and we discussed that in the last session, such as a mosque, they receive donations from people. And they know, by way of example, that X or Y person does not pay their chumps. Or, for example, they know that X or Y donation still has the chumps levied upon it. It's chumps pending. So we have this legal person, the mosque, they know that X or Y person, they're not chumps givers. Or they know X or Y donation. They know that the person is a good person and is a practicer. But what they've given, for whatever reason or however, the mosque has come to know that X or Y donation is chumps pending. Now, can they receive it or not? According to Ayatollah Sistani, it's halal for the mosque to accept. Again, because of the traditions of tahleel, whatever is transferred from a non-believer to a believer, okay, it's halal for the believer. There's no problem. The chumps is exempted. Even when you know that there's no chumps on it because that person either wasn't a Shia or was not a practicing Shia. So because of the traditions of tahleel, it becomes halal for the believers. However, concerning the donor, the chumps which pertain to X donation is now, because they've given it away, is transferred onto the donor's shoulders. Because the donor, in the last slide, when it was buying and selling between two people. So the seller sold the X item but received money in exchange. The chumps goes on that money. Here though, the donor who wasn't a practicer gave the chumps to the mosque. For the mosque it's okay. But for the donor, they didn't receive anything in exchange. So the chumps now is upon their shoulders now. And here one can either pay off one's responsibility, pay one-fifth of that which you've given to the mosque, or you can go to your religious authority, discuss the issue. They may or may not suggest another protocol for you. Okay. With Ayatollah Khomeini, though, there's no problem here to receive, because the chumps pertains to the dhimme of that donor and not to the concrete item, so there's no problem in receiving the concrete item anyway, the cash, for example. It's now only a liability for the duty bound, and it doesn't have no bearing on the actual thing donated. That duty bound, though, it went upon his or her dhimme, and they have to pay it off. Okay. Another scenario, these are different scenarios where one can now sense the importance, the significance of how chumps enters one's lives. Okay, let's say A and B, they enter a partnership, let's say of a business, together. Now, as their individual Chumash dates arrive, this is slide 48, A pays it off, pays their Chumash off. And imagine how B commits a shortcoming and does not pay his or her due Chumash. So they may be a Shia, a follower of the Shia denomination, but they've committed a shortcoming here. Or they may be a Christian partner, or a Jew, or a Sunni partner. No, doesn't make any difference here. The result being that when their money blends with one another for trading, there's a segment of that money which pertains to the 12th successor of the Holy Messenger. And therefore, using and exploiting it would entail usurpation, according to Ayatollah Sistani, because a fifth of it is not yours. Why? Because that person has blended with your money, their money, but their money, a fifth of it was the Imam's. And now it's entered your money. It's now one, it's one whole now. And now you're not allowed to use it because a percentage of that is the 12th Imam's. So Ayatollah Sistani, nevertheless, he exempts the believers, i.e. A, not B. He exempts the believers because of the hadith of exemption. Because now they're in partnership, they've received from their partner, it's okay for them to use it in this partnership. For the believer, it's okay. Because this Shia was not a practicer, or was a Christian, or a Jew, or a Sunni. So it's each to their own. A is exempted, but B would still have to pay the Chumash on his or her capital. The responsibility lies upon them. That is serious. And if they don't, they are just usurping the Imam's money. But in relation to A, the Ahlul Bayt have exempted them. With Ayatollah Khomeini, the partnership is fine for both, and they can both use it, irrespective. But what happens is with B, since they did not give their due, it went upon the dhimmi, and they have to pay that which they're liable for, towards the Imam. That responsibility still holds, is still intact. But they're free to use the concrete cash as they will. There's no problem in relation to the partnership. Whereas with the previous, with Ayatollah Sistani, it would have been problematic to even have the partnership if you were B. But if you were A, the practicing Shia, even though you know B doesn't give their Chumash, for you, the partnership is halal. But for B, it would be a case of usurpation. Okay. Another slide, slide number 49. Praying on a prayer mat or with clothes, okay, prayer mat or clothes, which have not had their Chumash given. Okay, what's the ruling here? So the Chumash date has arrived and they haven't paid the Chumash. And now you're praying on the prayer mat or with those clothes. So, let's say it was bought by yourself with non-chumsated money, for example, the annual gains of that year. This is problematic, and the prayers will be deemed void, according to Ayatollah Sistani. But if you went as a guest to someone's house, and the host offered you a prayer mat or clothes for you to wear to do the prayer, and those clothes or that prayer mat was not chumsated, here you, the believer, will be exempted. Okay, and your prayers will be sound. But if you were the host, or not the host, but let's say if you were the person who bought the prayer mat and the chums was not given, your prayers would be void, according to Ayatollah Sistani. Okay, and with, so here, this case is like if someone invites you over for dinner, you know they're not a chums giver, their food would be okay to consume, according to the Sharia. According to the Tariqa, we'll come to that in a minute. But in this same scenario, slide 49, with Ayatollah Khomeini, either scenario is unproblematic, validity-wise, i.e. the Salat will be valid in either scenario. So, let's say if you bought a prayer mat, you didn't give the chumps doesn't go on the prayer mat, so you won't be usurping. It goes upon your dhimme, and you can still pray on the prayer mat, according to Ayatollah Khamenei, contrary to what Ayatollah Sistani said. Okay, slide 50. Now let's say a deceased had willed, mentioned in their will, X amount of one's wealth to be khumsated. Or let's say their family members knew X amount needs to be khumsated. So we have someone who's a believer. They are a khums giver. And now they had mentioned in their will, whatever has, let's say, X amount, it needs to be khumsated. So the question of dhimme does not arise here with the deceased. Once you're deceased, the question of being it's on your shoulders doesn't apply now. And so what happens is that which is upon their shoulders now enters their wealth. And here the inheritors must pay of the khums before exploiting that which remains for themselves or other purposes. Otherwise, if they don't give the khums and exploit it, that which is their share, but they haven't given the khums when that deceased person said, look, this amount has to be khumsated. I haven't given the khums on this amount. And then that amount may still exist. It may still not, may not exist. There are different understandings here. If it still exists, there's one set of ruling. If it doesn't exist, another set of rulings. If it exists, then that which exists, the khums is on that concrete thing. If it doesn't, it goes on the dhimme of that person. But now they're deceased, they have no dhimme. It goes on the wealth in any case. I don't want to get into the minute details yet. But once we start going, dissecting the different classes in Appendix C, we would have to enter this kind of discussion. So, assuming they do usurp and spend the inheritors, if they do usurp because they know it's to be khumsated, but they spend it, they use it, they exploit that X item without having given the khums on it, they use it, that would be usurping. And assuming they do usurp and spend before sorting out the khums on that X amount, in proportion to their allocated fractions of inheritance, the inheritors must pay the khums of that amount usurped, in addition to the untouched amount, which is still khums pending too. So, just as an example. For example, X amount to be khumsated was £50,000. So the deceased person said, with this £50,000, give its khums, because I haven't given its khums. It may exist, that £50,000, or it may have been spent whilst that person did not pay its khums. So now the inheritors, let's say there's a brother and a sister. So usually the brother would get 2/3, the sister would get 1/3 of the share, assuming that there are no other inheritors like the parents or the spouse, for example. So we have a brother and a sister remaining. The brother gets 2/3, the sister gets 1/3. Here, the khums of that £50,000 is £10,000. And therefore, 2/3 of that £10,000 is the brother's responsibility. They would have to give two-thirds of it, which is £6,666 and 2.66, whatever. And the sister's share of the khums of that 10,000, which is khums due, the sister's share, she would have to give, it's very early for mathematics right now. So she would have to give £3,333 of that 10,000. That is her khums share. Now, here, 50,000 is their inheritance. 10,000 of it the khums has to be given. So it's 10,000. So the brother's share is 6,666. 0.66. The sister's share of the khums that she has to give is 3,333.33, continued. Now, then 40,000 remains, but they're not allowed to use that until the khums is given. That's the point. Here, they won't be allowed, according to Ayatollah Sistani here, to use this amount. Why? Because the khums has to be given first. The khums has penetrated, diffused through all that 50,000. Now, from that 40,000, their own, that their the inheritance would be, for example, for 26. So for the brother, it would be 26,666. For the sister, it would be £13,333. But they can only spend it once they've given their share of the khums. Otherwise, if they spend it, then they've usurped it, which is haram, and then they have to immediately pay it off, what they've usurped. They have to pay the imam's share. Okay. So, now, assuming only one of them commits to their share, but the other doesn't, here, let's say if the sister gives her share of the 10,000, which is £3,333, but the brother doesn't give his £6,666 share, but the sister does. Once she gives it, is she now free to spend her 13,333, which is what remains from the 40,000, which that's her share? The answer is yes, but with the permission of the religious authority, because still the brother hasn't paid it. Here, if you explain the scenario to the religious authority, usually they say it's okay for you to spend your share, but the brother still has to pay it off. He's not allowed to spend his share of the inheritance. Okay. Now, let's say all the 50,000 was spent, then this is what they had to do. They have to pay their share, because they usurped that the imam's share of that inheritance, because it was khums pending. But let's say they only spent from that 40,000 a bit of it. Okay, here that's okay. If only 10,000 of that 50,000 was spent. So from that 10,000 was due for khums, 40,000 remaining, but they didn't spend all the 40,000. It doesn't matter how much of the 40,000 they spent before giving the khums. It was usurped. It was usurped money. It was haram. But let's say that they spent everything from that 40,000. Well, here they have to pay the khums, as explained before. And if they only spent a part of it, or that part has to only be addressed and spent. They have no responsibility yet with that which they haven't spent. With Ayatollah Khomeini, there is the same ruling applies here. Because here, now, there is no dhimme for the deceased. It also goes into the concrete 50,000. And in practical terms, the same ruling would apply even with Ayatollah Khomeini. Okay, now this is a bit tricky, but since we're going to speak about this when we start dissecting each of the classes in Appendix C, you know, remember those things which never had the khums levied upon them in the first place, such as the dowry, blood money, one form of divorce, and the money which is a substitute for the divorce, or inheritance. We're going to discuss each of these in detail, inshallah, in another series, and there we'll go into this in more detail. This, I only wanted to explain here that the inheritors, when they receive something, but they're told it's khums pending in the will of the person who has deceased, when they're told that, they have a responsibility. They're not allowed to spend from that which remains from the deceased until the khums is paid off. If they do spend, then that's a case of usurping. The khums has to be given first, each to their own share. Okay. And finally, the people of the tariqa. And here, so all that we've said was in relation to the Sharia. And the ahadith on that, the exemption of the khums, was a bare minimum. It was a bare minimum for the believers. Nevertheless, if you're striving for a purer living, okay, you want to have a more purer living, even though it's okay to receive items from certain classes of people, knowing the khums hasn't been paid, you can still use them, it's halal for you, and you have no duty, but you can strive for a purer living. That was just a bare minimum afforded to you by the Sharia. For example, you can ensure that you are never a recipient of a property or a goods that have the khums yet to be paid upon them, even if it's a Christian, from a Christian or Jew. You can still calculate it. Or if you follow Ayatollah Khomeini, the tariqa there, on a par with his Sharia ruling, was you can ensure that you never delay the liberation of your liability. You want to free yourselves from any liability, that which you're in debt for. You want to free yourselves. You won't allow that to be delayed. You do it immediately. So you won't delay it, because with Ayatollah Khomeini, the khums goes on the dhimmah. You never allow the khums to remain in your dhimmah. You always liberate it. That's how the people of tariqa would maintain their lives. So with the first one, well, in both of these interpretations of the tariqa, that which is important is that you don't, in this process of ensuring that, be it according to Ayatollah Sistani, that the tariqa ruling of Ayatollah Sistani's Sharia ruling, if you want to ensure that you don't want to allow yourself to be a recipient of something which has the khums on it, even though the Sharia allows you to use it, but you won't until the khums is paid off, here it's very noble of you. And the same if you follow Ayatollah Khomeini, you would ensure that the dhimmah is never delayed. You pay it off quickly. But with Ayatollah Sistani's interpretation, the important thing is, and you're more susceptible here to fall spiritually, is you shouldn't investigate in such a manner whether X item has the khums paid on it or not, in such a manner whereby you break or compromise other people's dignity. You just have to calculate it for yourself. There's no need to tell anyone about it. It's a personal endeavor, and if the smallest dignity is compromised because of your action of investigating or scrutinizing others or backbiting, you've lost the plot. It's game over. Okay, so anyway, here the people of the tariqa, they suggest for you to go that extra yard, and that entails that you have no property or goods that have the khums yet to be paid on it, or you ensure that the dhimmah upon your shoulders is never there, i.e. you pay it off immediately, you don't delay. And at the end of the day, everyone to themselves, and everyone has to answer this question for themselves, that how much are you ready to strive for the imam's rights? Remember, the khums is the imam's share. The imam may forgive you or pardon his share, but you may still want to give him his right. You want to go that extra yard. Okay. So that ends our series on the first series on Homs. We've covered a lot of principles. We've covered most of the principles. There were a few things which are left in this important equation of annual gains minus ma'one divided by five. We've gone through everything in relation to it. But there are two domains which remain. One is capital and investments. Here, where does this fit in? And the answer is it fits in your annual gains. And therefore, if it's an annual gain, whatever is left, the Khums has to be paid at the Khums date. But there are many scenarios there. We have to touch upon them one by one. Another domain that we haven't touched is the domain of debts. And here, debts in this equation of annual gains minus ma'una divided by five, the debts here doesn't enter your annual gains. Because remember, with annual gains, it had to be a gain. It had to qualify as a gain or an earning, according to Ayatollah Khomeini. But when you borrow some money, okay, you haven't gained anything. You haven't gained anything. It doesn't qualify as a gain, so it won't enter your annual gains. But that too has exceptions and many scenarios. So these things we have to also cover. And also the classes of exemption in Appendix C, there too we haven't entered those in detail. We haven't dissected them in detail. We've just covered them in very general terms. So these are the discussions which remain for us to discuss, inshallah. Now, let's see how many questions we can answer in the time that remains. Suppose one did israf or wastage, tabdhir, and khums was deductible on these spendings. I'm not sure if deductible is the right term here, but you have to give the khums on it. Since these spendings would be counted at the end of the year as gains, that's correct, and not ma'one, that's correct. Is there any scenario where we could end up not paying khums on them or reversing the liability, like maybe our overall ma'une increasing at the end of the year, and thus these khums on the israf not being applicable? Please could you state any possible scenarios and give examples? I ask because if there are none and they cannot be equated exactly to the gains that we minus from at the end of the year, and rather are treated as maybe compulsory penalties for overspending, then there's no use waiting for the end of the year. We must pay the khums on this israf straight away because they cannot be removed. Okay, that's a very precise question, and there is no scenario to reverse it. Once the khums is on the israf, you've committed the israf and the khums is on it, that can't be reversed. Yes, you are free, however, to give it during the year, there and then, if you want. Or you can wait until the end. For example, let's say that thing remains with you. And let's say if it's a television or a second television or a third television. Or if it's rice, which was bought extravagantly. Here, if you want to pay from, see, when you want to pay the khums, if you wait at the end of the year, and then that thing which you did the israf in relation to is still with you, like a television or rice or whatever. If it's still with you, here, at the end of the year, you calculate all your leftovers of the annual gains. You calculate the amount of that which you did israf. You put it in one basket and you give a fifth. Okay? That would be okay. But let's say now, in the middle of the year, you want to give the khums of that israf television with something other, because you can't chop the television into five parts. So in the middle of the year, you didn't wait until the end of the year, where you estimate its price, and then all together in one basket, you calculate your khums. Rather, you want to now give it in the middle of the year. The television is with you, Israf television. Here, you want to give the khums on that with money which is yet to be khumsated from your annual gains of that year. This falls under the 1/4 principle, which we haven't discussed in detail, but you know the ruling, that when the khums of the television wants to be given from another money, okay, then a fourth has to be given, not a fifth. Assuming that money from which you want to give the khums of the television is non-khumsified or non-khumsated. Okay, but the easiest thing is to wait until the end of the year, put all your annual gains and the estimate price of those Israf, let's say the Israf television, put it all in one basket and then pay a fifth. That's why we don't stress for you to pay off the, we're not emphasizing for you to pay off the khums on the Israf there and then. Because you need to then exercise the 1/4 principle. Not that you're paying more or less, you're paying exactly the same. But recalling the principle, not many people know of this 1/4 principle. But let's say now you want to pay the khums of that thing which you did Israf in relation to in the middle of the year, but it's now not present with you. For example, you gave a dinner party. It was a lavish Israf dinner party. Now, the party food is not with you anymore. Here, the 1/4 principle doesn't hold. So if you want to give it in the middle of the year, a fifth would apply. So that would be okay and reasonable to do. The other one, giving 1/4, if let's say the Israf item was present within you, that's okay to do also in the middle of the year. But since you want to pay the khums of it through non-khumsated money, then a fourth of it would have to be given. Okay, but the easiest is putting it all in one basket at the end of the year and then giving its khums. Okay, another question. In session 6, you talked about half a bottle of perfume being applicable to khums. But is that not considered as one piece? And thus, if we use an item once, it should no longer be applicable for khums levy. Suppose if I bought a bottle of soft drink one day before khums and I drank half of it. So you say khums would be applicable on the other half of the liquid when the khums date arrives. Would it not be considered as one used item? Or are you talking about Eastern fragrance like oud, attar, etc., which can be measured, separated from the original size and resold again, perhaps based on weight in smaller batches? But Western perfumes come as a unique product, a closed single design bottle, and I have not seen a half-used bottle of Western perfume ever being resold in the market. It's like selling a half-drunk bottle of soft drink. I think the concept of Western perfumes is quite different. It is sprayed, not taken out and rubbed on hand. So what is your feedback? That's a very good question, actually. And look, the general criterion is if any extra remains and it qualifies as mal, remember, a belonging where it has value. And so if an extra remains, and according to Urf, the common layperson, they see it as something of value, then the khums has to be given. Now here, with the half-drunk Coca-Cola, when you drink half of it, the common layperson would not see that as something of value for them to long for. So they won't see it as malon because it's been drunk. I mean, it won't be sold, for example. Or with the Western fragrance or perfumes example that you use, that for the common layperson, they won't long for a half-used bottle of perfume. That I agree, and the general criterion is if any extra remains and it's deemed as a mal before Urf, before the common layperson of your society, whatever society you are, then the khums has to be given. Okay, now, here, imagine that the perfume example that you gave, that if it was to be half used, here it will never be sold in the market. And according to the common layperson, they would never long for it. I accept that. Because it's been used. It's been used once, it's one piece, it's been used. But let's say haven't you ever come across those Oxfam shops or car boot sales which sell perfume? And the perfume is second hand. What will you say there? So if it has, there's a longing for it, not market price, but a car boot price, you have to calculate the car boot price. If there's no longing for it, and where you are, the common layperson will never long for it. If they see it in a car boot sale even, okay, there's no longing. There's no longing for it. And the same applies with the Coca, with the soft drink that you mentioned. With the soft drink, if it's half drunk, okay. But what if in a car boot sale, they sell, don't they sell, for example, at a very, like 5 pence or 10 pence, plastic cups of Coca-Cola? They may have used it from a half-used bottle. See, what I'm trying to get at is, let me give you the general criterion. Then you have to judge the specific particularities and the applications. And that is that if any extra remains and it's deemed as mal, according to the common layperson of your society, now the mal means a belonging. There has to be a longing for it, something which one sees as something of value. And if there is that malon, if it qualifies as malon, then the khums would have to be given if the khums state arrives and that extra is there. And so I leave it to you, but definitely based on taqwa and you going the extra yard, that precautionary yard, it would be safe to do and give the khums of even the half-used Coca-Cola bottle and perfume. Okay. Is khums applicable if we spend more than our financial budget allows within it, if it's considered a norm within society? So there would be no khums if such a spending by someone whose budget is less, okay, if it was to be deemed normal for them to spend more, if their budget is less and they spent more and it's not deemed as israf by the common layperson, there would be no khums there. But you have to now ascertain what the orf, the common layperson's judgment in relation to what you've spent. Do they deem it normal? Do they deem it as not being israf? If that's the case, then no khums will be levied there. So this is what you have to ask yourself. What would the common layperson, what would orf say after an informed orf? So after they know about your background and they see your expenses, they see your status quo. When they see you then spend more than that which your financial budget allows. It's less, your budget is less, but you're spending more than that which you're allowed to do. You have to see how orf ascertains such an action. If they see it as israf, it's problematic. If not, then that would be okay. There would be no khums levied. Also, what if we spend more than our financial budget allows as a need to save our face and maintain respect? So here too, no khums will be levied if by not spending, this leads to, according to the common layperson, leads to embarrassment and it's of harm or burden to you. No khums will be levied in such a case. Otherwise, the Homs would be levied. So here again, you have to see how Orff would make that judgment. Would Orff say, look, if they don't spend, this is going to lead to embarrassment, harm, let them do it. If that's the case, no Homs. Otherwise, the Homs is levied. If we spend, is the Homs applicable? If we spend less than our financial budget, but the Israf is considered as a necessity within society, in any common layman's eyes, and thus also to save face and maintain respect. Well, the way you phrase the question, you leave no choice for me. In those areas where necessity applies, okay, no Homs will be levied, only in those areas. Because you're saying it's in every common lame person's eyes, it's considered a necessity. So as a general question, I can only answer in such a manner, in general terms. But then you give examples. You say a grand wedding, a honeymoon expense, as the society expects such expenses as are given out of marriage, or hosting the in-laws of the husband or wife, or any important guest. Well, look, first of all, the way you phrase the question, it's out of necessity, every common layman's eyes. But when you give so I said in those areas where necessity applies, no Homs is levied. But in all the three examples that you gave, if there's Israf there, you can't. You would have to give the Homs. None of these are necessary. None of these are seen as necessary. No, who says you have to have a grand wedding? Who says you have to pay more for in-laws? This is not a good culture to have. And Homs is a manner where it wants to maintain these wrong expectations arising in the first place. Now, still, if you believe that these three are a necessity and all the common lay people think like that, okay, there's no Homs. But I'm saying if I were to have these three, I would certainly give the Homs, because I don't see any of these as necessary. Okay. If I care about quality, technology, organic produce, etc., and the family or society around me only considers the economic side of things, and thus considers me doing israf on my spending, am I doing israf, and thus Homs becomes liable on me as a result, when I personally believe it is not due? It is not due my considerations of israf being different. For example, economic $1 manual toothbrush, their israf, and mine not. A $10 battery-powered, well-designed automatic toothbrush. My israf, because beyond my budget, and then $80 latest technology toothbrush. If you can try to write more lucidly, so I can understand exactly what you're trying to say. The English has to be improved a bit here. Also, would the $80 toothbrush be considered israf in a time, if I'm financially easily capable to afford it one day in the future, and the family or society will consider the $10 toothbrush still as israf? So look, although I think I've understood the question, but the criterion is that what do the informed common lay person, the informed Orff, what do they say in relation to that product and the duty bound, you, for example? And you have to ascertain how Orff will reply. So when they see you, they see your situation, your status quo, they see your background, and then they make a judgment. How would Orff see that? And remember that sometimes something may be Israf, according to Orff today, for someone whose financial capacity is even high. But that thing may be Israf today, but 10 years down the line, it may not be Israf by the same Orff. So things evolve over time. So it's difficult. So if you can rephrase that, it may be easier for me. Okay, there are many questions that still remain. Yes, I mean, another question is it possible we are overcomplicating Homs rules with all the Israf waste, etc., and the laws of Ma'une, like the people of Musa, who were told to simply produce a cow, but due to their overthinking and picking on matters, a long list of specifications of a particular type of cow was then conveyed upon by Allah through Musa alayhi salam. Similarly, in the hadith you presented earlier on the session, Imam alayhi salam only wrote khums as applicable after removing expenses without overcomplicating matters for the masses at the time within the letter, with conditions and exclusions such as israf, etc. So it is possible our scholars could be overthinking and trying to reach to that special yellow cow by overcomplicating ma'une with all the conditions and exclusions in the major occultation. So here the precision is good, that what the ulama are giving, the precisions are good. At the end of the day, people are asking, so they have to give. They're not overcomplicating things. But the lifestyle of the people are becoming complicated, and that's why they keep on asking for the minutia, and the ulama have to answer. Even the precision of the duty bound is good. Okay, there are things which are important for their daily life, they want to know. That which is bad is waswas. Whenever waswas enters the picture, be it by the ulama or the duty bound, that is game over, and that would be bad. But I have to add this, that okay, going into the duty bound, when they go into the precise details, it's okay. But when you explain this to the religious authority, many times they turn the blind eye and they say it's okay, just go ahead with it. It's not as if they're going to calculate every penny of your khums. They do pardon a significant amount. Okay, I'll stop there with your permission, though I have maybe 30 or 40 questions that need to be answered, but inshallah another time. All the best inshallah. وصلى الله على محمد وآله الطاهرين.